Juliana. From JulianaHatfield.com. You are the camera. Bed was my I Hate the Music Industry album. When I wrote it, I'd just been dropped from Atlantic Records, who had declined to release the last album that I recorded for them. You Are the Camera was my attempt to explore the vanity, artifice, shallowness, meanness, selfishness, coldness, heartlessness, dishonesty of the entertainment business, and to admit my own guilt, shame, and embarrassment at being part of this system that exploits women, people, and their art. To let one's music be sold involves some necessary amount of fakery, illusion, and collusion in the sales, marketing, whoring process, even if it's just the makeup on your face. In the beginning, during the whole Blake Babies reign, I didn't wear makeup, in defiance. You can see I'm wearing no makeup, none, on any of the Blake Babies albums or EP photographs. In You Are the Camera, I'm mocking myself for having gotten myself into the mess I was in. Even the la-las at the end are bitter and hating themselves. There's no joy in the la-las. They are self-consciously constructed and placed rather than bursting out spontaneous and carefrees like la-las usually are. Sonically and structurally, I was trying with this song to be arty and rock and kind of difficult and obscure. I thought it would come across as cool to do things that were not expected or understood. I didn't want the song to go down easy like pop, so I did things like making the melody different in each verse, and making the melody indiscernible in the third verse, and making the intro chord transitioning into the first verse chord a tritone, otherwise known as an augmented fourth, the sound of a European ambulance, an unpretty interval. The song is scolding myself for doing this at all, for building songs and releasing them out into the cruel world, for wanting and needing attention from an audience and critics, for needing to be seen, heard, consumed, praised in order to feel good about myself. But I only want to be seen in a certain way. I want to be able to control it. I want you to think I'm cool. I mean, I am cool, but there are parts of me that are not so cool. I only want you to see the cool part, the good-looking part, my good sides. So I give you pieces of me, a torso, a clavicle, an arm, eyes, legs, a bunch of carefully formed words, but I am thoroughly conscious, if I can help it, of everything I choose to give, though it all often backfires anyway, despite my best intentions. The fact that I still want and need and court an audience to be appreciated and acknowledged by total strangers seems to me a failing, a weakness, a character flaw. I consider the fact that I submit myself and my work over and over again to the judgment of random people, when I have such a low opinion of humanity, myself included in general, to be seriously twisted. Doesn't make any sense. Why do I care what any of you think? Why does anyone care what I think? A woman my age should be comfortable enough in her skin, mature enough, sensible enough, to eschew the random and sometimes uninformed and unintelligent opinions of those whom she doesn't know well and care about and trust. But so many of us need to be mirrored in others. We need to be reflected back at ourselves to feel we have any idea of who the hell we are. I look right at you and see myself. That's when you try and look deeply into someone's eyes, right up close, and all you really see in there is your own reflection, a tiny, eye-sized reflection of your own face. It's weird, frightening, cool. That is really the root of the problem. We are all, ultimately, totally alone, and we fight this fact. The you of the song title is you, and it's American culture, and it's my superego, and it's TMZ, although I don't think TMZ existed when I wrote the song in 1997. And it's your cell phone held up, pointed toward the stage at a concert, and it's the person who's actually sitting right next to me on the couch, the person I will never really know and who will never really know me, because communication is impossible and futile. Almost every kind of rebellion, tattoos, drugs and drug abuse, porn, sex, has been commodified and nullified by overexposure to the world by cameras. Do you feel you don't fully exist until or unless a camera is recording your experience? Do you believe nothing is real or interesting, important or meaningful unless you see it played back for you on a screen? Ever see Videodrome? I used to want to try to be myself in photos, with no special trickery or heavy makeup or flattering lighting or smiles, but now I can see that trying to present myself as myself is futile and pointless, because there is no self that the camera can capture. It's what's inside that makes us who we are. simplicity is beautiful. Simplicity is beautiful. That was just a thought I had one day. As far as I know, it was an original thought, but I'm sure a lot of people have thought the same thing at one time or another. I guess you could say it's a philosophy or a way of life, or could be, if I could stick to it and live by it day by day. But often there are just too many piles of unanswered, unanswerable questions and problems and emotional and residual gunk clogging up my head and heart. I may seem complicated and inconsistent, but really, I'm just a simple girl. Give me a plate of fried clams and a Corona and a sunset, or in the absence of a sunset, a Red Sox game on the TV, and I am happy as a pig in shit. I think simplicity is beautiful is beautiful. The whole thing involves only 5 chords, though neither the vocal arrangement nor the guitar solo, or the overall effect of the recording, is simple, so the song kind of contradicts itself. The lyrics are so uncomplicated as to be borderline retarded, so I fear if I The lyrics are so uncomplicated as to be borderline retarded, and so I fear telling you all the words. They're not meant to be read, but to be part of the whole vibe of the song. The vocal arrangement, as it builds on itself and the harmonies come in, is a tad complex, and that is why I've only played the song a handful of times ever live. It's hard to hold those long, low notes at the beginning, the ones that go up a step at the end of each long-held phrase while playing guitar. The guitar solo, too, is a tricky, complicated mess. I don't think I could ever reproduce it. It was a few takes, a few moments of inspired improvisation that the recording engineers, producers happened to capture on tape. Yes, tape, it was a 2-inch analog tape recording. Anyway, the solo is 2 or more, 3 maybe, solos that I liked. I couldn't decide which was the best, on top of each other. Sometimes doing different things, and sometimes, like in the beginning and at the end of the solo, coming together. It's the opposite of simplicity, I guess, intertwining melodic leads with no real rhyme or reason, without a plan. There is some order and some lovely, unharnessed chaos, just like life. I think it is really pretty, simple or not. It says something to me, and I wasn't sure what I was trying to say. Something about the pain and ecstasy and heartbreak and joy of living. It's a mystery where this feeling comes from, or how it got there in the song. How chords and melodies can convey so much that resonates with so many people from all over the place is magic. But it's not my magic. I didn't make it up or create it. It's the magic that already exists. I just happened to find some of it and grab onto it for a few minutes. I started off the guitar solo with a theft. I took the vocal melody from Dinosaur Jr.'s Tar Pit from the You're Living All Over Me album, one of my biggest musical inspirations, and played an interpretation of it at the beginning of the solo, and then I went where it took me, into some other world, into my world. The song had been conceived when I picked up my guitar one day and went to play the 2-verse chords of Tar Pit on my guitar using bar chords, but unbeknownst to me, my guitar was in drop D tuning, and what came out of my guitar as I attempted to play the Tar Pit chords with the drop D tuning was something so pretty and sad and wonderful that it had to be a song, my song. An excellent accident. sunshine. At some point in my early 30s, around the time of my father's death in 2001, I kind of all of a sudden realized that I'd been completely miserable all through my 20s. Even before that, since adolescence, from the dawning of self-consciousness, I had been a depressed, self-loathing, self-destructive, self-critical, cripplingly shy, socially inept, isolated, angry, sad, immature, frustrated, loveless wretch. And I realized that I was sick of it, sick of being so miserable, especially when I had so many reasons not to be miserable. Good physical health, work I loved, work I would hesitate to even call work, and which had supported me financially, didn't make me rich, but I didn't have to have a day job since I got signed in the early 90s. Fans, freedom, independence, reasonably good looks. My high school and college years were most definitely not the best years of my life. And a little later, when I was having all the success with my career and music, I couldn't enjoy it for the most part because I was so unhappy. I had little confidence as a person. I believed in my work sometimes, or at least in the idea of the responsibility to carry it out. But I never believed I was a very lovable human being when I was around other human beings. I knew I had potential, but I never thought I was achieving it fully. And I knew that some people thought of me and my music as a flash in the pan, a joke, a bad, dumb, silly, forgettable, worthless, weightless bit of nothing, a wisp of a blip on the radar of history. I was hyper aware of all the negative criticism being readily leveled against me over the years, and all of it reinforced the low opinion I already had of myself. I soaked it all up and let it swamp me in a swamp of unrelenting self-doubt. I was like a perpetually wet sponge, sunk. Positive assessments of me and my work did register, sort of, but I didn't always believe them, and they didn't make the harsh ones sting any less. On the Stairmaster the other day, I was reading a recent interview with Madonna, and in it the wise woman says, "You have to get to a point where you care as little about getting smoke blown up your ass as you do when you become a whipping boy in the press, because ultimately they both add up to shit. You just have to keep doing your work and hope and pray somebody's dialing into your frequency." In Sunshine, I am having some mercy on myself, showing some forgiveness and compassion and understanding. My heart is breaking and healing all at once for my young, messed up self, and by default for everyone else going through the same stuff. Sometimes in my songs, when I say you, I mean me. When I say you get happy with a sugar buzz, that's me I'm describing. But happy is the wrong word. I meant temporarily distracted from the fact that you are, I am, unhappy. I was never one to escape from feelings I didn't want to feel by overindulging in drugs or drink. My numbing tactic was to stuff my face with sweet foods, like there was a lack of sweetness in my life, like there was a hole that I needed to fill, and I wanted to fill it with the sweetest things I could find. I'd eat a lot of sugary crap, or go underneath the covers to blind myself to my personal emo psychic pain. But now I wanted to stop all that. I wanted to figure things out, figure out why I'd been so miserable for so long, and to try to stop feeling so miserable. I thought, must this continue for the rest of my life? Did I not have any say in the matter? Was I doomed to be forever depressed, to be always alone and isolated, afraid to reach out or open my mouth or heart to people, afraid of being dissed or criticized or rejected or laughed at or hurt or ridiculed, doomed to think I was a stupid, boring, no-talent loser when really, actually, I wasn't? When I was growing up, my brains and my skills were nurtured, but other parts of me were not so much. Partly as a result, I believe I wasn't fully functioning when I went out into the world. I didn't know how to live, how to get along with people, how to interact, how to give and take, how to forge bonds. I basically lost a whole decade, my 20s, stuck, not growing up, not doing the normal life things people do in the normal course of their adult development. The parts of me that weren't music kind of wilted on the vine, and in Sunshine, I'm wondering if it's maybe not too late to revive them, those latent, languishing, yet-to-blossom blossoms. Maybe there was some happiness and peace and self-love hidden deep inside of me. Maybe I could dig it out. Out from under the dark, heavy blankets into the sunshine, to overstate the song's cliched metaphor. I have never been ecstatic was a simple statement of fact. Always subdued, dour, gloomy, skeptical, untrusting. I wanted for once to experience joy and jumping up and down release. My wasted youth refers to all the years that I wasted not on drugs, but on being unhappy and closed off to all the people that I never knew because I was so racked with self-doubt and hatred. so stifled by shyness and an inability to communicate on a person-to-person level. Sometimes I swear my only communication with anyone was with you people, the fans out there who came to the shows and listened to what I was saying in the music. I look forward to feeling better in my 40s than I ever did before. I mean, it can only get better as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't go back to my 20s for all the money in the world. Well, maybe for $1 million. I told you I have my price. It's $1 million. But the song isn't happy Hollywood ending. I'm not there yet. I wouldn't call myself happy or contented. I'm still angry, surly, frustrated, lonely, confused, sad, yearning, etc. Some of the time. I'm not standing fully in the sunshine yet. I want to stand in the sunshine, is what I'm saying. This is a process of evolution, a forward motion. Looking back sometimes is okay. It puts everything in perspective to see where we are in comparison to where we've been. I wouldn't want to go back, and that's a good thing, I think. Everybody gets down sometimes. You get happy with a sugar buzz. White chocolate eggs is your favorite drug. I go underneath the covers. There are things I do not understand. When I reach out, will you slap my hand? Drugs. This one's pretty self-explanatory. I had a drug addict boyfriend. You don't know him. He wasn't famous. I've had more than one drug addict boyfriend, actually, but this song focuses on one particular guy. I didn't hate the guy or look down on him for having this problem. Having a drug problem makes a kind of sense in this cruel world. I mean, who doesn't want to escape from all the random, ever-present meanness and bigotry and hatred and all the millions of kinds of pain and suffering? I sometimes wonder why I never developed a drug problem. I seemed like the perfect candidate. Insecure, self-absorbed, artistic, prone to depression. The guy was clean when I met him, but after a few months with me, he needed the drugs again. Like I said, I can't really blame him. Besides, I'd drive anyone to drugs. I just want to clarify something. The one part of the song that is factually totally false is the ultimatum part. I say it's me or drugs, you choose drugs, is so not me. That never happened. It just sounded good in the song. Same with I withhold your medicine. I never did that either. He was technically gone by the time he actually got his hands on any of his medicine, and before I could have withheld it, if I had wanted to withhold it. I am not the ultimatum-issuing type. I am a fatalist. I say let people make their own mistakes, especially when it comes to addicts. Addicts don't ever get straight for real until they decide, on their own, to do it for themselves, right? And so I would never say anything as futile and unrealistic as, "It's mere drugs, buddy. Choose." That's so manipulative. I would either leave or deal with the situation as it was. And he left before I had a chance to decide whether or not to leave. Plus, I think "choose life" as a slogan is so cartoonish and ridiculous. As if it were that easy to just end a serious addiction with the power of positive thinking and logic and a snap of the fingers, that I just had to mock it. If you think it's that simple, then I have to assume that you have no deep-seated emotional or psychological damage, and so you don't understand what drives people to drugs, or to death, to the opposite of life. To say one can choose life like choosing an ice cream cone flavor would mean one could also choose to be an addict, or choose not to be hurt by someone. Which seems absurd to me. At the time of the song, I wasn't so sympathetic to the guy, but I have mellowed and grown more empathetic with age. He left on his own. It wasn't because I made him choose. He made his own very clear decision to leave me and go back to his former love, heroin. It's understandable. One good thing he left me before he left me was the verse chord progression of this song in that cool, unique guitar tuning with the low, low C on the bottom. I can't tell you the rest of the strings notes because I want to keep it a secret. He came up with the tuning on his own, I think, and I've never seen or heard anyone else play with it. It has a very special, poignant sound, don't you think? That was what he left me. All of my mistakes and my suffering can be turned into music. That way, I don't have to take my occasional rage out on other people whom I really don't want to hurt, no matter how much they hurt me. Two wrongs never make a right. The world would be such a better place if all people could channel their anger and pain and feelings of powerlessness into pretty melodies and clever turns of phrase, wouldn't it?
Just
bad day. My older brother and I were once held up as we were walking across an outdoor parking lot at night. There were about 6 young guys, teenagers I think, in sweatshirts, baggy jeans, and baseball caps. My brother and I thought they were just going to amble past us, but then one of them pulled out a little silver handgun and pointed it at my brother's head. I was standing right next to him. I don't remember anyone saying anything. We were all relatively calm and no one panicked or yelled or made any sudden movements. My hand went automatically to my pocket where there was a little wad of cash, $80 I think, and I immediately handed it over to the kid closest to me. My brother gave him his wallet. Then the kids took off running down the bike path next to the parking lot. My brother called the cops and filed a police report. The perpetrators were never caught, but I didn't care. I was just glad to be alive. The feeling I had directly following the incident was one of intense gratitude. I wanted to thank those little punks for not shooting or killing me or my brother. The whole one-minute robbery was like an impressively well-executed business transaction. Couldn't have gone more smoothly. Everyone did what they were supposed to do. The boys demanded something from us, clearly and forcefully, without giving us any opportunity to negotiate, and so we gave them what they wanted without resisting or questioning, which would have been stupid since they had a gun. Then they left, and no one got hurt. End of story. I had my dog with me without a leash, and even she knew to play it cool and not aggravate the situation. She just stood there next to me, calm, didn't bark or try to attack. Which was kind of incredible, because normally she barks or lunges at people she senses are potentially threatening. She knew what was up. She knew not to resist 6 young guys with at least one gun that we knew of. I thought that $80 was a very reasonable price to pay for my life. I was actually glad I had that much, a good amount of cash on me, because any less might have pissed the guys off. I don't think I was angry at all at the time. I was just so relieved not to have been shot, and for my brother not to have been shot, that I felt lucky more than anything else. I could tell myself that they were just misguided kids and that maybe they'd grow out of their junior thuggery into something kinder and gentler. But of course, if I or my brother or my dog had been shot, I probably would have felt differently about the whole thing. It's obscene the amount of gun violence in the USA, the disrespect for life of all kinds. That's why I wanted to thank those kids. They spared my life, and my brother's too. That mugging was not the only time I've been put in an unpleasant position by someone wielding some temporary authority over my peace of mind. I have since been the victim of serious crimes against my peace of mind, but it's better for me and for them and for the world if I don't take it personally and I maintain my composure and forgive every time it happens. You have to think of injustice and violence and societal ugliness like a disease, a chronic, incurable disease. It's not your fault, and you can't make it go completely away, but you can try to manage it and live with it. Yes, it's a constant struggle to remain peaceful and loving and calm and compassionate and patient and forgiving, but it's a fight worth fighting, because the world will be better without so much hatred and anger and violence. I'm not a bad person, and God doesn't hate you. That's not why we were stricken with this disease. It's just random tough luck. I'm like you. You're like me. We are both like everyone else. You are as vulnerable to ugliness and darkness as everyone else. It's good to know this, so when the sickness flares up, you won't take it personally and think God is trying to punish you. With a bad day, I was relating my mugging to my life at the time. I had trouble with relationships. I went for guys who didn't treat me right, and in the song, I equate the bad boyfriend archetype to the mugger. I screwed it up again. I made another friend, a desperado named Trouble. He showed his gun to me, he took my money, etc. I'm basically blaming myself for getting hurt. And the mugging is a metaphor for the trouble I seem to keep getting myself into. I made my bed, and now I don't sleep in it so well. I made bad choices back then. I was either drawn to people who would hurt me, or I ran away from the ones who could be good to me. Either way, I would end up alone, confused, ashamed, and missing something, feeling I'd screwed up. I didn't understand myself.
Screwed it up. me now. This room is such a mess. I really don't know how.
The first line, "You left the state without me," was taken straight from the mouth of George Hurley, drummer for Firehose and before that the Minutemen. The story goes something like this. The Blake Babies were touring with Firehose. Ed Crawford, Firehose singer-guitarist, had accidentally dropped and broken John Strom's guitar the night before, and he insisted on buying John a new one. So the next day, Ed and Strom, along with Mike Watt, Firehose and Minutemen bass player, went guitar shopping. This was in New York, I think. Ed and Watt were supposed to meet George and the Firehose crew at a certain time at a certain corner and then drive down to the next gig in Richmond, Virginia in the Firehose van. But one of the two parties got their plan screwed up. And so when Ed and Watt went to the corner they thought was the meeting place, George and the crew guy weren't there. And this was before cell phones, so neither party could call to find out where the other was. So Strom suggested that Ed and Watt ride along with us, the Blake Babies, in our van to Richmond. Watt was uneasy about leaving without half of his posse, but he had no choice, really. He didn't know where they were. So Watt and Ed rode with us. When we arrived at the club in Richmond and Hurley saw Watt emerge from the Blake Babies van, he ran up to Watt and jumped on him, punching, shouting, "You fucking left the state without me." A band is tight, a unit, like a gang or a marriage or a family, and shouldn't be split up. George was pretty pissed off, hurt. I've heard of this happening, bands getting split up accidentally before. The Volcano Suns, the great Boston band of the late 80s, once left their bass player John Williams at the Sturbridge, Massachusetts rest stop on the Massachusetts Turnpike on the way back to Boston from points west, and then continued all the way home about 80 miles before they realized that John wasn't in the van. What happened was this. John was sleeping in the back of the van under a blanket. Peter Prescott, Volcano Suns drummer-singer, who was driving, stopped to get a snack at the Sturbridge rest stop on the pike. He parked the van, went in to get his candy, and while he was inside, John woke up and went into the restroom to pee. While John was in the bathroom, Peter returned to the van, and thinking John was still asleep, okay, this is boring, cut this, I heard of this happening, cut that whole paragraph. So I had a line from which to push off. You left the state without me. Often one line or a title will get me going on a larger idea. The idea of this song was the push-pull of ambivalence, my simultaneous attraction and repulsion toward potential love objects. Feeling a longing for a connection to someone but pulling away before getting too close, or not being able to get close, being more than just afraid. I've only ever been truly at ease when I'm all by myself. For the longest time I thought this meant there was something really, seriously, fundamentally wrong with me, but now I've begun to accept this truth about myself. I am most comfortable, most myself, when I'm alone. And I'm fine being alone. Happy, even. I know that when I'm writing, I'm content. And sometimes, when the writing is going well, I'm ecstatic. When I was working on my book, I was calmer, more at peace than I've been in a long time. Than maybe I have ever been. In little pieces, I'm feeling an emotional connection, or what I would call a new love with someone. but I have no claim on him because I haven't really given or invested anything, because I don't want to give up my freedom by becoming his girlfriend, and yet still, it hurts to see him with other girls, because I have strong feelings for him. I don't want to talk it over, and I never cried on anyone's shoulder means I want to remain free and independent, and I want to be strong. But I'm aware that there's a price to be paid for my freedom and independence. Loneliness, isolation, feeling like an antisocial freak in a world full of very sociable, verbal creatures. In perpetual exile from the human race and from what we are all conditioned and pushed to believe is normal. What society pretty much imposes on us, even when it is not necessary in terms of money, safety, procreation, coupledom, marriage, community, etc. I feel this pressure, especially as a woman. We women are made to feel that we must find a mate, a guy, a husband, a protector, a father to our future children. There is no historical or filmic archetype of the female lone wolf. Maybe there is in mythology. Artemis? But why? Why is someone like me, alone by choice, pitied if I don't have a ball and chain? Why am I seen as abnormal, bereft? I've always felt less than 100% myself whenever I've been half of a couple. It makes sense, doesn't it? To be one part of a couple means, by definition, that you are literally one half. Is it any wonder I haven't ever figured out how to feel whole as a girlfriend or wife? Though it is a choice to be alone, it is also a cross to bear. It is a kind of curse, an exile imposed by destiny, nature, genetics. It is a conundrum. Am I defective, needing so much solitude? Is there something wrong with me, pushing away from contact with other humans? Or is it society's, or the powerful, ruling patriarchy's ubiquitous, relentless pressure making me feel that it's not okay to be alone? Buddhism, the most sensible, applicable religion, in my opinion, advocates the abolition, or rather, the dissipation of desire. Well, doesn't it follow that curing yourself of desire for other humans, for love, affection, reassurance, comfort, is a positive, necessary stepping stone on the path to nirvana, to peace, to individuation, to enlightenment? I aspire to need and want no one. That is my dream. To never need or want anyone or anything. Then I will be like Buddha. And yet when I'm alone, something sometimes isn't right. Is this because something is missing or lost being alone, or is it simply that unless you are Buddha, Buddha's enlightenment is impossible, and that man's condition, being alive, necessitates that existence is not fully satisfying and is fraught with periodic, palpable emptiness, no matter what your situation, alone or not? You're on Earth. There's no cure for that, says one of Samuel Beckett's characters. That's how it is on this bitch of an Earth.
I don't wanna.
Congratulations. Congratulations is a song about temptation and not giving into it. I found a way to throw in the word jelly roll because I wanted to, was always trying to vie for inclusion into the rock and roll continuum, which started back with all the blues guys who sang about jelly roll. And then there was Lou Reed. I wanted to be included in that club, the Rock and Roll Boys Club, for the same reason I named my first album Hey Babe, like Lou Reed sang. It all comes back to Lou Reed, doesn't it? You can learn by trial and error to exercise restraint and self-control, and to be always conscious of the fact that actions have consequences and that it is a choice to act. If you ignore this, it can lead to trouble, complications, problems, hangovers, hangers-on, stomach aches. It really is better sometimes to just say no. The two people in the song realize this. Though he doesn't say much and only shows up in the chorus and at the end, the guy's important because he isn't just at the receiving end of my, let's just say the I in the song is me, rejection. He feels the same way I do, doubtful, skeptical. I know the fire, but none of the afterglow. When verbally contemplating our mutual attraction, the guy says in the chorus, I am equally wary, mirroring my own hesitancy. We are wary of jumping in and acting upon our mutual desire for one another. We are looking ahead to the future negative repercussions of our actions' attraction to each other by looking back to what has happened in the past when we have acted impulsively and indulged other desires. We have acquired maturity, or maybe just pessimism and dread, and so we don't do it. We don't pursue it. We walk away. And so congratulations are due as the guy shuts the door behind him and leaves my house, nothing having happened between us. We deserve pats on the back for showing restraint, for not being stupid and blasting forward in the heat of the moment, for nipping this thing in the bud, for rejecting intense, ravenous feelings as selfish and gross and irrational and untrustworthy, for saying no, for knowing that anything of any value and truth and meaning will endure even if you don't grab onto it desperately and try to own it or consume it, especially if you don't. The guy and I are in agreement that hooking up wouldn't ultimately benefit us. It would maybe satisfy a momentary urge, but we both have enough foresight to realize that it would behoove us to think of the future and not act upon this shallow, momentary urge. I ain't an animal, I say, making a stand for free will. I'm not a monkey. I can make informed decisions. I am not biologically destined to screw indiscriminately like a bonobo. I have a brain. I can use it. I can be smart. I can say no. I can choose to be alone and a virgin. Well, I could, back in the day. Desire, not anything more. Just let it be. Let it fade away. Don't be a slave to it. It doesn't have to lead to anything. Be strong. Be smart. I made up the guy in the song. He doesn't exist. I have since encountered guys like this. Guys with good heads on their shoulders who were so super cool that they could make the rational decision to pull themselves away while in the throes of a strong desire. My father gave me some unsolicited advice when I was a young girl. He said, "You want to know the three best ways to get to know someone? The three best ways to get to know someone are to get drunk with him, play poker with him, or sleep with him." I think my dad was right on about the poker, but I think he was completely wrong about the sleeping with someone. A person doesn't have to disclose anything about himself during sex. It's how come prostitutes are able to be bad at or afraid of intimacy and good at protecting, hiding their vulnerable selves. And that is why at the end of the song I sing, I am he is me. It is only by deliberately not giving in to our base animal instincts that we are able to really connect on a higher, better level and to understand each other intellectually and to feel satisfied that we have done the right thing. Or maybe I meant that as soon as he was gone, he disappeared from my consciousness like the smoke from a cigarette, as if he never existed. Lust is a roadblock that keeps us from really being intimate with the deepest, realest parts of ourselves. It's a primitive animal instinct left over from when we were apes and needed to produce offspring in order to stay alive. Humans should have evolved past lust by this point. That's why we have to use our brains to veto it when it doesn't make practical sense.
I'm not afraid to die.
the lights. In the lights, I was feeling really, really down, so I went to the little beach at the bay late at night to look out over the water and up into the sky to try to find some solace. There was a bright moon glowing, shining on the water. It was a mostly clear night with a few slowly drifting clouds backlit by the moon. There were lights and houses off in the distance across the bay. There were stars. There was the occasional silent blast of heat lightning far away. I don't remember if the Roman candle really happened somewhere off across the bay on the other beach over there, or if I made it up to add to my list of light things in the song. The night seemed suddenly so alive. There was so much light, so many kinds of light, such illumination in the dark, such brightness coming from so many places. I imagine that if I had walked into the water, there would have been phosphorescence making ghostly neon white trails swirl around my feet. It was like a secret world with a special kind of vibrating, metaphysical, more awake than daytime energy that apparently came to life only when people were tucked away sleeping in their houses. And so I was a privileged witness to it. All the lights made me feel protected and warm and comforted, like I wasn't alone, surrounded by them. Like the beach and everything within my sight and the land off across the water, curving around the bay, was my home, and the sky was the protective ceiling. Like this world loved me. I was overwhelmed by the beautiful heartbreakingness of it. I was distraught still, because I was alone, still, and I couldn't share this wonderful secret world with anyone. I yearned for understanding. Why did I have to be alone? And peace. And so I looked as hard as I could, with my eyes open as wide as I could make them. Out, up, around, wanting to know why it couldn't be like this and stay like this. This peaceful, quiet, nighttime dream world, all the time. Wondering how I could get out of my normal everyday hole for good and feel better and strong and illuminated, instead of often feeling so dark and heavy and weighted with lethargy, sadness, confusion, agony. Isn't Evan's guitar interlude beautiful? It's perfectly moody and mournful. Pretty and dreamy and dark and shimmery. All at the same time.